Hello again, everybody. Welcome. This is Julie Knutson with the podcast Training the Pointing Labrador, episode number 121. Today's episode is going to be on a single topic, and it's going to be, again, like most of mine, oriented toward retriever stuff. So it's, you know, the very specific things that I talk about might not apply to everybody, but I think the general philosophy and personal approach does kind of have to do with all of us and all of our dogs. And what I'm going to talk about is, unless you are, I can't even think of what it would be. Most of us, whether we are the reining expert wherever we are, whether we're a professional trainer or just the one with all the experience, or we're somebody who's building up, you know, trying to get better and better all the time, a lot of our dog work, if not the vast majority of it, occurs basically when we're on our own or with our small training group and making our own decisions and kind of planning out our own things. So even all of us, those of us who do it for a living and those who just have a dog or two or three that we're working with for whatever reason, or we just have a couple dogs that we own and, you know, coexist with and share life experiences with. One of the big problems that people have, and it's not really a problem, but I think it's a perceived problem, is how do I get better at what I'm doing when I'm doing all this by myself? And I imagine a lot of you listening to me have had, somewhere along the line, have had that thought. You know, it's like, all right, I know this much, but there's a whole bunch of stuff that I don't know. And what do I need to do to get better at what I'm doing? So one of the first things we go for, right, is we get on the internet, we get on YouTube, we get on, various websites and things, and we look at what other people do and what other people say, and anything that resonates with us in what they say, we kind of grab onto. And if it doesn't really resonate with us, we just reject it. And so that's a way a lot of people do, or you have somebody, you know, near you that has more experience or air quotes knows more than you. Sometimes that's a little sketchy or doubtful, but so whatever they say, they kind of design up your program and then you do what they tell you. And it's very hard to get better when you're just doing what someone tells you. You might get better at doing what you're told, but in terms of becoming within yourself a better trainer and handler and manager of animals, not so much. And so I'd like to throw out some ideas for people who would like to be better at what they do when they do a lot of their work all by themselves. And I don't know if many people have thought about this, but I've kind of lived this life. And so I feel comfortable talking about some of the things that I've thought about and done over a lot of years of doing this. And I'm not going to tell everybody how many years I've been competing with dogs, but it's a lot. I started when I was 10, officially doing AKC stuff when I was 10. And here I am, you know, at 105, still doing it. So it's been a long, long time. And in that time, and I learned from my father how to get to the very best you can as soon as you can. In other words, I learned from him, he was a horse guy, that if you're going to go learn stuff from somebody, go find the absolute best person that there is. Even if it's tremendously inconvenient to get to them or to deal with, find them or hook up with them, or they're very hard to reach, do whatever it takes. Only go to the very best people that there are. And so that's how I was raised. That's how I was brought up. That's what I saw. That's how, you know, everything was done back then. And so that's how I've done this in my life. And so I've had the privilege and pleasure of learning from some of the very best dog trainers that are in the country today. And that's priceless. And that's the way to do it, to go to someone, to people who have clearly demonstrated a depth of knowledge and understanding and execution of things at the highest level consistently, repeatedly, and then also have the ability to communicate that to others. That's very important. So when you go to resources to get help. Do, you know, go to the very best that you can, not the fanciest, coolest looking stuff, but go to the very best that you can and take full advantage of that, right? That's what I did. I recommend that everybody do that. But that's not what happens on the days when you're out doing some of your dog work. And how do you manage that situation, right? How do we, okay, I listen to everything that there is that I want to hear. I understand what they've said. And now I'm going to go out and undertake some of this with my own animal. So let's break this down into its fundamental pieces, which is the only way I know how to approach anything in the world. So we're going to break this down. So it's you and your dog, and you have a certain knowledge base, whatever that is. And you, I hope, have gone to some outside resources to get the information that you want, to see what the dog work is like or what the expectation should be. So a lot of times seminars can be useful in terms of seeing how certain things are done, seeing what the results are. So let's say you've done a fair amount of that and you kind of have an idea, and you spend most of the time working by yourself or with, you know, a friend or a partner or something, and you guys are doing this. So how do you, instead of just staying status quo and never really getting better and maybe getting a little sloppy sometimes, because there's a lot of things that happen when you train by yourself, and what I want to talk about those things. But the first thing that you have to do when you go into this is you have to break this down into the program that you're undertaking. What I see frequently, but you know, everybody, people who do their dog stuff, they love it. They love the dogs. They love the other people that share this love, and it's so fun, and they go out and they do stuff, and somebody sets up the work that you're going to do, and somebody else tells you how to, and so you kind of just go through the motions and stuff, and you're doing whatever, but it's just fun. Oh, it's a good day. We had a real good day. Okay, you don't have that when you're by yourself. You don't have somebody who's just driving the boat, and you're just getting pulled along behind on an inner tube. Okay, that's, when you don't have that, you have to have in your mind what it is ultimately you're trying to do. And this is really true. And if you're not that kind of person who does that sort of thing, you need, if you want to get better at what you're doing, you need to take on that perspective. So if you have, a couple dogs and you want to, and I'm going to use the retriever stuff, you know, you want to go run the hunt test next year and you'd like to, you know, do it at a fairly high level and be successful. So, and you train with other people that do it, and this guy says do it this way or that way. You spend a lot of time by yourself. You need to take these things and break them down into, okay, where am I and what is my future goal? And future goal cannot be, you know, I really want to run some hunt tests next year. I don't know where, I just really, that's nice. but you have to have some kind of desired outcome. Doesn't mean you're going to get it. Doesn't mean you might not surpass it, but you have to have something out there that's your desired outcome so that you now, at least you have a start and a finish. And now we're going to design the trajectory and the route that we're going to take to get there. So for the sake of example here, let's say, because this is called Training the Pointing Labrador, and the APLA system just kind of, season just sort of wrapped up. Let's say, you know, next year I want to go run the master level of that. I want to go do the master level of the APLA. And my dog is, you know, he's pretty good. He does this and that. And so I would really like to do that. And you don't do it by just going and training with a bunch of other people that are doing that same thing. Because again, you might do whatever they tell you to do, but there's not a lot of learning in there for you. There is some, of course, because you get to see. But you need to go, all right, I want to run a master next year. And my dog right now is, he's got good obedience. He points. He retrieves on land and water. I have those basics, and I got to do some more things. So you don't start. What people do is they get, all right, that they have a double and a diversion and a blind on land and water, and then they have to be steady in the upland field. So I'm going to start teaching him doubles, and I'm going to And so people, you know, you got kind of this, we're going to practice my old analogy. I'm going to just practice getting ready for the algebra test by just taking algebra tests. Again, that doesn't work. You have to learn algebra fundamentals and learn them really well. And then you can take whatever algebra test comes up. You don't have to practice that so much. So how do you do this by yourself? So with help from more knowledgeable people, it would be, the thing to do would be create this trajectory, where you are and where you want to get to. And then on your end result, saying that we're going to use the example, we got the master level test. So on that end result, what all is involved in that? And very specifically, and I mean very specifically, you may have to read the rules, you may have to ask people who have done this a lot, what are the very specific requirements that you have? Okay, everything is off leash, no collar, just dog free, right? So then, in other words, they have to be really good. They have to be steady on the line, even though you may speak to them, to steady them up. You can't scream and yell or intimidate, but they have to be steady. And they have to be able to run marks well. And these marks might be very straightforward, and these marks might be really tricky, just depending on, you know, where you are and who's judging and what they think is a good setup. So you have to have a dog that is steady, pays attention, marks, can handle diversions. Dogs that can handle on land and on water. So these dogs are steady, focused, they mark, they handle, they can handle on marks if they need to. And then also out in the upland field, they need to be able to hunt the entire time, cover all of the ground, locate birds, hold their point, be steady to inadvertent flushes, be steady to flush, be steady to shot, and then continue to hunt as long as the judges require you to do it. Okay, that's a lot of stuff. And all of these stuff that I just talked about, you need to break down into its component pieces. So don't run out and start doing doubles or start practicing blinds by, you know, go approach all that stuff the correct way. This is the stuff you're supposed to learn from the videos and the experts and the other people. Learn about how you teach each of those things. So then decide what order you want to teach these things. And get help again from somebody that really does know some things on this stuff. So now you have to have this plan. And this plan is, you can't really function without a plan. It'd be like somebody giving you a car and saying, hurry, get to grandma's house, and they didn't tell you where that was. And so you can drive all you want, but you really don't know where to turn and where to go. So you have to have this plan. I'm going to start here. It has these pieces to it. And this, my end result is this. And then set out in ways to accomplish those things in ways that make sense. Okay, now you can't just on your own, if you're new to this, figure out all the ways that make sense. So this is where you want to find out from people who have done this many, many times successfully with different kinds of dogs. At least find out, you know, what their approach is. Now, if it doesn't make sense to you or you're not comfortable with it, which sometimes happens, then go find another source of information. There's plenty of them out there. There's a lot of good people. Make sure they're good people, not the ones that talk the most to have all the answers, but the ones that have behind them have done the things consistently and repeatedly that you're hoping to do. Okay, so I'm not going to go into the plan development and all that. I think I've done that before on some podcasts in the past. I want to go on the personal aspect of this now. So you have a plan, and you, part of this plan when you put it together is the schedule that you have from now fall and winter, because we have short days and we have weather and we have jobs and we have other obligations, all of which factor into this. You need to, if this is important to you, make this a priority. It's like anything else. It's like eating well or exercise. If it's important to you, you'll find the time. So if doing some dog work with your dog every day is important because you want to go to that master next spring and be successful and really enjoy it, build a little bit of time into virtually every day that you can. If you have to get up in the morning and do stuff into the lights of the parking lot, then do that. You know, if you have to go home at lunch, take a little extra lunch and stay longer in the evening to make up for stuff at work, so you can go home and spend a half hour and do some of the specific work with your dog. So part of, once you have your plan, then build a schedule in that goes with that and kind of adhere to it, because if it's important, you will. And if it's not important, you won't. So build that in. It is feasible. It really is feasible. Before I was married and had kids and stuff, and I was competing in field trials, and I worked full time, and I was still competing in field trials. So I'd had to do this deal where I would come home and I only had 45 minutes, and I would go run some water blinds or do some whatever I could do. And it had to be a priority, and it was. And so I know it can be done when you're a working person. Maybe with this COVID thing, it's either a little easier because you're home, or more difficult because it's because you get the whole kids. It can be very difficult. But that notwithstanding, build a schedule in so that, you know, on Sundays I have a couple hours. That's when we can go do some setups. We can do some marked retrieves with other people with frozen birds and guns and real stuff, or water if you have access to that. And then the other days you can do more of the little things, the pile work and the casting and lining and the wool breaking and all that kind of stuff. You can put those things in, not all jammed together, but you can build all that stuff in and then build in the progression that you're going to make. You don't know how fast it's going to take for you to wool break your dog or collar condition your dog or do the pile work and get the tee going. There isn't a magic number, because some dogs go very quickly and other dogs do not. But you build in that I'm going to do this, and when that's finished, we're going to move into that transition into the, starting to run our sight blinds, our pattern blinds. Build that stuff in, and it doesn't take, when you do setups, you only have to do a couple setups, that's it. When you're doing some, your difficult work, your pile work or your double T, that's 10 minutes. That's 10 minutes, and we run out of dog attention. So make sure that you build reality into here. It's not a function of how much time you have. It's a function of your dog's attention span. All right, so you got a plan, and you got your trajectory planned. You need to do that. At least rough it out now and then make adjustments as you learn more. But let's say you're doing a lot of this and you've watched videos and you've seen some people do some things and you're training your dog. So how do you get better as a trainer when you're doing a lot of this work by yourself instead of going the other direction? One of the phenomena that occurs with all of us, with all trainers, is when you're training by yourself a lot, you tend to become very self-absorbed in the stuff that you like or the stuff that you're good at. And some of the other important things that you're either unaware of or just not, don't enjoy or don't care that much about, they begin to slip. And I've seen some real good trainers that spend a lot of time by themselves. And, after they come out and train or something, and you look at them and the dog obedience is kind of weak, and the dog's pointed a little bit the wrong direction on things, and they have to say stuff twice, and you can just see that some looseness in terms of the relationship between the two of them have occurred, because nobody was there to point out, hey, your dog's pointed wrong, you had to say sit three times before the dog, or he's scooting ahead a couple feet before stuff happens. So it's very easy for looseness and slop to develop. Very easy for that to happen. Matter of fact, it's very hard not to have it happen if you really do spend a lot of time by yourself. Unless you make certain priorities every day while you go into this. But I want to say that that's a thing that happens a lot. You can often tell people who train a lot by themselves because the precision and the crispness isn't there because there's no need to. There's nobody around going, hey, that Yeah, does they sit 3 times? Look at him, moved 2 feet up. What's going on? You don't have that. And so you don't notice a lot of things. So one of the things when you train by yourself a lot, and I know this from personal experience, one of the things you have to do is as you go into every daily training session, and I don't care what you're doing, it could be the most rudimentary walking on a leash, heel and sit, or it could be, you know, finishing off the double T and getting that left cast going the right way and all that stuff. No matter what it is, when you go into this, you need to go in with a set of expectations for yourself. Instead of thinking so much about your dog, you need to sit there and go, all right, I need to make sure that I give whatever commands I give one time only. One time. And if I have to give it twice, that points out a problem to me. I do not have that relationship with this dog where they are taking me as seriously as I need them to. So, and I don't know, you know, I don't know you and what your thing is. So I'll just talk about stuff that I do. I need to give a command one time. If I keep noticing that my dog is pulling or doing, you know, pulling ahead or lagging behind as I'm going over to do something, there's a problem right there. I haven't even got to the activity. We're going to go over and do some power work, and this dog is kind of ignoring me as we're walking over there. Okay? There's your sign. So if you get very involved in the minutia of what you're doing, just the most simple things. Did the dog get out of whatever you took him out of and then run away the other direction from you? Okay, there's a sign. Don't be just because your mind is on, what am I going to do when I'm done this training? I got to go run this errand. And your dog's showing you all kinds of disrespect and you don't even notice. So those kind of things are very, very helpful. If you just become very mindful. That's another reason your training sessions can't be long, because it's hard to stay that way. So if you, as you begin, you're going, all right, I need to be aware of the very small things here and what this dog is telling me. And when they're telling me that they're not paying attention or they're not taking me seriously or they're confused or they're afraid or whatever I've created, I notice that first off, because you need to deal with that before you start any of your training. So whether you're on your trajectory that you've written down, every day, be very mindful and have in your mind, all right, today, as I begin this, I'm going to take into account what the dog's state of mind is and what they're telling me. I'm going to find out, do I have to give commands multiple times or just one time? Do I find the dog being very loose or very crisp with me? If you can do that every day when you train, then you are way ahead of the game. Then you're not going to have the slop that can build in up close to you. Because when you have that kind of, I'm kind of listening, kind of not stuff going on right there with you, as you begin to do things where the dog's doing retrieves or blinds or whatever kind of out in the field kind of work that you're doing, whatever slop you have where you're in each other's proximity really grows out in the field. I would say it's an exponential kind of a growth. So if they're kind of scooting ahead and wanting to go, and then they'll break. And then when they get out there and get to the area where the bird fell, then they're going, as soon as I pick it up, I got to go back. I don't want to go back. I'm going to run around a little bit more. And you're going, what's the matter with this dog? Well, they already told you way early on, you know, hey, I'm not really taking you seriously. And then they go out there and really don't take you seriously. And then you get upset. And then the training session kind of gets out of hand, and it never had to. So one of the ways when you train by yourself, because you don't have somebody nagging you going, what'd you do that for? Look at that dog. You know, in a training group, sometimes as annoying as that is, at least it keeps you on your toes. But when you're training by yourself, you have to keep yourself on your toes. And you have to have some things in your mind, some criteria. All right. And it needs to begin from moment one when you and the dog are together. Because if you're going to be doing teaching, which is all that training is, you need to find out the state of your student, state of mind. You know, do they feel all right? Are they paying attention? What is their attitude toward me? Do I like it? Do I not like it? If I don't like it, I need to change it. I need to get this dog into a receptive mode for learning the things that we're doing and, you know, enjoying it at the same time. So that's probably one of the most important things you can do, is develop that criteria for yourself, your standards, and your dog from the very first moment you get them out. And if you start that way, then you can just build it up as you go and make sure that the dog doesn't take a little step ahead if you're going to do some retrieves. Or that they sit when you're doing, say, some blind or some handling work, and they sit crooked and look over to the side wishing all this nonsense would end. You need to respond to their attitude and what they're telling you. You also need to take full responsibility for it. So if they're not taking you seriously, it's because you've led them to believe that was okay. So everything that I'm talking about is not let's punish the dog. It's let's get a better handler here, a more mindful handler that's coming in on this thing early enough. So that's one of the most important things. Now, what do you do when there's a problem, some behavior comes up that you don't know what to do? And it's going to be hard to come to examples. I need to come up with an example of this, but always when we're training, and when we're not, even those of us that have done it a long time, stuff happens and you're sitting there going, what in the heck was that? I don't know how to interpret that. I don't know what that means. That happens a lot. Or your dog, let me give an example. I've had somebody recently, their dog would, when they'd send them on a mark or a blind, the dog wouldn't go most of the time, not all the time. It would just sit there. And so they'd have to come up with another word, find the magic word that made the dog go. And so they had this problem and didn't really, they knew it wasn't good, but they didn't know that it was a really bad problem because, you know, if you're competing and your dog no goes, you're out. Bless, the dog doesn't have an option on whether they go or no. So what do you do when, if you have a problem, your dog's doing stuff and you know it's not exactly right, but you don't know, is this a big problem? What do I do about this? What happens? So, and there's a zillion problems. Your dog might no go. Your dog might sit on a whistle when you're handling them out to about 90 yards. And then after that, they just don't sit on the whistle anymore for whatever reason. All of this stuff is created by the handlers, by the way. I just want to make sure you know. It's not intentionally created, but it is. Because they started to do these things and you didn't respond to them, or you didn't early on teach them, you know, there's no choices here on this stuff. When you hear the sit whistle, you have to. So it's always us. We did this when they do these things. May not have been intentional, but we did it. So when you come into a problem, like the dog doesn't go, or the dog is, you know, he'll sit on a whistle, he gets out 90 yards, then he's hunting, and I can't, no matter what, I use electric collar, nothing, he doesn't pay any attention. So how do you figure out when you're sitting there going, geez, I wish I had Mike Lardy standing there next to me to tell me what to do? Of course, he'd be telling you that you caused all this problem and you need to back up and start over. But what do you do by yourself, right? So, because I've been in this situation so many times where I've had, not those specific problems, because those are all ones that you never let develop to begin with, but I've had some other ones, you know, like the one I think I told in another podcast where my really good pointing dog just started pointing and busting birds and then stopping, and, you know, it was like, what the heck? How did I do this? You know, and the problem was basic obedience. So problems come up and you're sitting there going, I don't know what to do. So what do you do? One, if you don't know that no going is a big problem, then you're probably not going to know that you should do something about it. But let me tell you, how do we define problems, particularly if you're not super experienced? So in the dog world, in the retriever world, and kind of everywhere else, but there are several things that are absolutes. Absolutes in our retriever world. And that is, one, when you send your dog on a retrieve, they need to go and get whatever you sent them for and bring it back. Right? There's nothing else is acceptable. They can't go out there and go, I cannot find it. Just coming back, then you handle. You never want the dog ever to believe that they're going to be sent on something and may or may not wind up coming back with it. So that's one thing. Excuse me. So if your dog is doing things and you wish to not have them retrieve because of it, don't do that. Don't teach them that, you know, sometimes you retrieve, sometimes you don't. Never know, because then they don't have that full conviction. Wherever that bird went down, I've got to go get it. Right? So they have to have that conviction. That's an absolute. The other thing is, whenever you tell your dog to sit or whatever it is you say to them, whether it's at your side or 120 yards out in the field, they have to sit. Okay, that's an absolute. So not sitting is not an option. Just like coming back going, can't find it, it's not there, is not an option. And the third sin in the dog world, retriever world, is when I send you, when I tell you to go, you have to go. You cannot go, don't think so. Or, well, I'm not sure I agree. Or whatever it is. The things aren't right. I can't go. That is another thing that they can't do. So as you carry into all of your dog training, those are three things that if anything happens, you must address that problem right there. Dogs have to go when they're sent, stop when they're told to stop, and bring stuff back. So I hope that for the new people, that particular piece of information is helpful. So if any of those things are not working, you need to go after that. And so you fix the no-go is I'm not going to go into, if your dog has been forced on the pile and been through the double T, then they understand that they must go. So you don't burn them ever on back on that. You walk forward and say heel with some pressure to force movement. And there's a whole way, that's fully written up in the book and in other good places. You don't burn them on back. You don't make that a nightmare. Just put pressure on heeling forward a few feet, put your hand down, send them again. That's if they have been through, forced to the pile and done all that work. If they haven't, then I'm not aware of any tools that you have. So that's why you want a good handling program. So that your dog you have the tools to say you've got to go. And the same thing with the stop, right? If the dog is not stopping on the whistle, then you go way back to basic obedience and you go back in with the collar conditioning and the stopping on the whistle. If you don't use any electricity on this, then you've just got to use a whole lot of repetition on the rope and on close-in stuff to get them to stop. But you need to address that problem. Preferably, don't address this on the blind you're handling when they're out at 110 yards running crazy and you're sitting there laying on the electric collar and nothing's happening. Not the place to address it. Remove that your dog from that situation. Go back to your basic obedience. Go back to the double T, which I hope you've done, which is where, again, I stop them on a rope first, then I use electricity, and then do a lot of that work until those dogs understand sit whistle means sit. And then, you know, just handle on anything when they need to come back with stuff. So even if you have to walk out there and help them or have your gunner help them, never let them learn that they can come back without anything. So those are some absolutes that you have to deal with. Generally, the other places where you're dealing with stuff, it's going to be because your fundamentals, your basic obedience is not what it needs to be. So the relationship and the respect is not what it needs to be. But you've got to be able to sit there and break that down in your mind while the dog is doing things. Again, on that blind problem, the dog will, you know, he'll go out to about 90 yards, sit on the whistle. But if he gets past that, he doesn't stop anymore. Okay. Break that problem down to what it is. This dog has been taught that so far you do something, after that you don't have to. So go make yourself some pattern blinds. And one of them is 300 yards long, and one of them is 200 yards long, and one of them is 150 yards long. And handle the heck out of them till they learn. I just stop on a whistle all the time. So there are many common sense ways to solve problems that if you break it down to just what the problem is, you can do it. Again, so your dog goes out past 100 yards, 90 yards, and he won't sit on the whistle. Instead of going, I'm going to turn the collar up you know, let me get, instead of that, go, the dog is, seems to be very distance dependent on their response. So I need to remove distance from it. And I'll do that on a sight blind, on blinds that they know, pattern blinds. Make some real long ones somewhere, even though I have to drive a long ways to set it up, until I can go handle that dog every 5 or 10 seconds all the way out to 300 yards. Now you're going to come back and run your blinds. You're probably not going to have so much of a problem. So it's when things happen with your dog, instead of just defaulting to, I got to ask somebody, I don't know what's happening here. You can fall back on yourself going, okay, let's see. Let's break it down. He's not sitting on a whistle. And it seems to be only at this distance. So what can I do all by myself to teach this dog to sit on a whistle at a distance? Just that single act by itself, not associated with marks or any other things. So assuming you trained them to handle, you've got to have some sight blinds or pattern blinds somewhere. Get some long ones in there. Break this down to the pieces and go after that problem. Now, just for my pointing people, my upland people, I'm going to just go a little bit into the upland field stuff, because weird stuff happens out there. And boy, when you ask for upland advice, you get stuff all over the map. When I hear people, you know, talking about stuff, I hear stuff I've never thought of or heard of before. So there is so much information out there. And when you're in the upland field, it's not just a place where you can, like on a marker blind, you know, you kind of know the basics of that. You got to have them force fetch. You got to have them steady. They got to like to retrieve. They got to go come out straight back. That stuff can be broken down into its fundamentals fairly easily. The upland field, less so. So what I'm going to throw at that, and I think in the book, I spent a lot of time. I think it was called The Five Priorities, right? First one was responsiveness, et cetera, et cetera. So it broke down all these things to use to problem solve things with your dog. And the first one was always responsiveness. So everything that I've talked about prior to this, dog's not going, dog's not sitting, dog's being loose and sloppy, that means the responsiveness is not there. That is the first thing you have in all of your dog work all of the time. Now, there's people you can watch with their dogs where there's almost none. You know, it's like, okay, don't watch that. I see that all the time and go, how can you stand having the dog ignore you? I don't even understand how that works. But dogs have to be responsive. So again, in the other stuff that we're talking about, if they are not responsive and doing what you ask and understanding and not like robotic, right? But understanding what the expectation is and the standard is and carrying it out for you, then you're going to have all of these other kind of problems. But you can solve them by breaking it down to where this dog is not responding, isolate that behavior, go address that separately, and then come back and reintegrate it into your regular dog work. It's that simple. Now, in the upland field, I have had to break this stuff down because I've been seeing so much strange stuff and I'm going, I don't even know what to do here. So I've had to develop a way to kind of break it down. All right. The first thing I have to have in the upland field is responsiveness. In other words, this dog and I need to be together on this. That's why I emphatically say you got to teach them what gun range is, even when they're pointers. Later on, you know, when they rock solid and know the game, they can go out 250 yards and point. They're not going to move. So now we can extend, unless that's running birds out of the field. Got to be careful about that. But dogs need to know in the beginning what's gun range and that it's their responsibility to stay in that. So if you don't have that, you're going to have all kind of problems. What do I do when my dog gets too far? What do I do when he's busting birds up? What do I do when he chases something? Well, your dog needs to stay in gun range first. They need to be with you. You guys need to be a team on this. Need to be a team. So first, you've got to have the responsiveness so that they know you're there and they know where you are and they know what direction you're going and they know that it's their responsibility to stay with you. Got to have that. If you don't have that, never mind the other stuff, because they're going to just do whatever they want. So after you have that responsiveness, okay, the next thing we have to have is this love of finding for birds. That's the next thing. They have to, this is their heroin field, or should be. So they should be very, very excited about what it is they're going to go do. If you don't have that, and frankly, you have to have that first. Even though responsiveness is the most important thing, when you have little puppies, young dogs, put them on birds and let them just chase heck out of them. Let them run them down. Let them, you know, get bush in there and push them out. And if they grab them, they grab them. They're not in trouble for that. You have to have them where they love this activity. You have to have that first. Now, if your dog is not a little puppy, now you got to be a little careful. It's just much easier to do when they're little. And so you can just turn them loose, you know, and they can't run three counties over. You can always go get them. You need them to love that. If you do not have that, you have to get that. And if your dog is 2 years old and has never been on birds, you cannot go out there and make it a rule-filled place. Lots of rules. You can't have that. They have to go, oh, this is awesome. This is so exciting. They have feathers and they fly and they smell this way and they make noise. If you don't have that, then you can have a lot of problems. Or you have a dog that dutifully goes out and stands somewhere and nobody wants to see it and nobody wants to judge it and nobody wants a puppy out of that. And they don't even know if the dog's any good or not. Seen many pointing dogs. People have asked me, what do you think of so-and-so? It's like, I have no idea. Because when I see them, their training has screwed them up so much, I have no idea if that's a great pointer, not a great pointer, or anything else. So you want them to love it, okay? Then we need them to be responsive. So then once they love that stuff, then we start teaching them, there's some rules out here. And you've got to stay with me. And so if you don't have that, you know, you're going to have chasing, busting. If they don't respect you, then they're not going to respect you when they're on the birds. And they're going to probably opt to do what they want versus what you want. Now, some dogs hold point, never move. Yay, I love that. But some dogs hold point, and then if it moves or they see it or you get close or they get competitive, then they don't hold point anymore. So there comes some training for that. But before you train them what the rules on a bird are, they have do love the bird, and in my opinion, they have to point the bird so that you know that you've got an actual pointer, and they need to develop that stuff in as unfettered a way as possible so that they get to have a lot of boldness and conviction about what they're doing. So many problems that people encounter in the upland field stem from these missing pieces that I've talked about right here. So if you understand how the dog best evolves through this upland thing, then it's helpful to address the problems while you're doing it. So I'm going to say it one more time. They have to love the birds. They have to know a little bit about it. They've got to know they're out there and that they have to use their nose. And sometimes they can use their eyes, but they have to use every sense that they have, and that it's their job to find them. And then you find out what interaction they have when they do find them, right? And then after they're excited about that, then you start to put the rules in there. Okay, but you've got to be with me. You've got to hunt within this certain deal. I'll honor your nose and something when you tell me there's a bird. I won't call you off of it. You know, don't do that. But so you have to know what your dog's doing and pay a lot of attention so you're not calling them off birds, because now birds are bad. And now you got all kind of problems there. So a lot to think about. There's a lot to think about when you go in the upland field. And those of us that have to do it all the time, you know, you kind of learn that stuff. But if you haven't, you're just walking out there going, oh, look, this is so fun. And there's all this stuff happening with the dog. And I've watched so many people when they're trying to go through a field the correct way, right? The correct way. And their dog has said, I just got scent of a bird. And you can tell, I mean, there's a bird there and there, but they're going through the field the correct, and they call their dog off. I have seen it happen enough times where somebody called it off a couple times because they're going through the field the way that they should. And by that third bird encounter, the dog's going, heck with this, I'm just going to go get it. So it's important to, as you're trying to troubleshoot stuff, to make sure you're not the trouble. So you do have to pay attention to your dog. And if they find a bird, which is what you're out there for, unless it's in an unsafe or a dangerous situation, You need to honor what you've taught, you know, want your dog to do. So you have to be aware of that. If you keep calling them off and you're going, why are they always jumping in on birds? And you're clueless to what you've done. You need to be, again, just like on the other work, very mindful of what you're doing and what your dog is doing. But you should, at every instant that you're in the upland field, you should know exactly what your dog is thinking. If you're not watching your dog, then you're not training your dog. Or you don't, they might be, again, if they are on a bird and starting to change direction and go over toward it, unless there's some very compelling reason not to, let's go over there and let the dog do this. There may be a compelling reason not to. It may be, you know, in a bad place or under the barbed wire fence or something. Then you do have to call them off. But at least be aware and wise to what your dog is saying to you and doing. And if you are, then you can react accordingly. But if you're not paying attention to what your dog is saying and doing, then you might be causing some problems. So we have full circled now back to the very first thing I said in the beginning of this. And that is, as you're going out to do your basic work, whatever it is, obediency stuff, whatever, the first thing you have to do is be aware of what your dog is thinking and telling you. That's what you respond to, and that's where you set your standard and your work and what you're going to begin with. And that's true on the most fundamental things of heel and sit. And it's true out here in the upland field. It's exactly the same thing. So when you go out to do that work, it's not like, okay, I got some birds out there and I got this. Now let's go. You have to sit there and you're getting Fang out of the vehicle or where, whatever you're doing. And, you know, how is Fang? What's happening? Is Fang under control? Is there the responsiveness there? Or is he just wild and crazy? Now, what do I need out of this? If he's kind of wild and crazy, do I need to go over here and remind him about our relationship? Do some fundamental basic obedience work. When he goes out in the field, you need to pay attention. Is he resentful of stuff you've been doing? Because you can see resentful in a dog just like you can a kid. You know, and it's like, heck with what you, whatever you say, I'm going to do the opposite. So you got to watch for that kind of thing. What are they doing? What are they telling you? If you want to be able to identify problems and solve problems with dogs, then you have to be completely tuned into them because they are telling you stuff. You have to listen. And if you can identify that, then you can, again, go back to fundamental basics. Don't address the problem out there in the field. Go back and go, geez, this dog is just tuning me out. I'm not going to do upland. I'm going to go do some other stuff and then come back to this kind of work after I have reestablished the relationship that we have to have. That's going to solve, believe it or not, a lot of your problems. And then when you have your training plan and you know the progression that you want to go down, you follow that road. But when you reach a place where, wait a minute, we have regressed, then you don't continue forward. You identify the root cause of what the problem is. You go back, you address that isolated behavior, and then you come back and you keep going. So you don't have to be the world's expert in dog training, but you do have to be a thinker and be aware, and you have to require of yourself that you do this before you engage with your dog and while you're engaging with your dog. So that's often the biggest challenge. It's rarely the dog that's the biggest challenge. It's the person and what's in their head, because they are, if they're not directly connected with that dog, then it can be a little bit difficult. So I offer that to everybody that's out there by themselves. Never lower your standards. You don't have to do that. It all hinges on your own self-awareness and what you are identifying each training session with, what it is you'd like to accomplish. And before you even engage in your training session, let's see where my student is and how they're doing and what they're telling me. And I will respond to that. And by being so responsive to them, I will, just through experience, teach them to also be very responsive to me. Works really well. So I hope that's helpful to the people that are out there on the weekends and the evenings and the mornings by themselves. It's just a little bit of thinking, isolating, and you don't always have to have an expert there if you just understand how to break things down into just fundamental pieces. So I hope everybody is doing well, hoping they're really having a good hunting season and safe. And I'll be back with the next episode soon.